This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Well, greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you the day after the 4th of July. We're back in our studios here at AM 620 KPOJ, Portland, broadcasting live all across the United States at 9 a.m. Pacific time, noon Eastern time. Well, 6 minutes after thereof. In the second hour of our program, Devin Herrick is going to join us. He is with the National Center for Policy Analysis, one of these new hard-right think tanks, telling us how wrong Michael Moore is. It should be an interesting conversation, because in our third hour, Sarah Van Gelder is going to join us, the executive editor of Yes Magazine, who actually went down to Cuba to check out their healthcare system. Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress will be with us. And in our Best of the Rest of the News segment, two bloggers are coming on at 11:30 Pacific time, at 34 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program. Steve Rendell from FAIR.org, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and Faiz Shakir of ThinkProgress.org, which these are both some of my favorite blogs. A lot going on in the news, which we will be getting to as we continue through the day. I've got the new Republican Party poll that they're sending out to everybody. It should be very entertaining. Some further thoughts on the Scooter Libby commutation and an extraordinary little quote that Carl Wolfson, who does the local show here on AM 620 KPOJ, shared with me just before we went on the air. I want to share with you as time goes on. And some thoughts on the legality of that. The exploding car bomb mythology, we're going to get back into that Larry Johnson was talking about. Right now, Andy Gause is with us. Andy Gause is the author of The Secret World of Money. His website, AndyGause, GAUSE.com. Andy is a, I don't want to say financial advisor, kind of money guru, Andy. Would that be a reasonable thing to call you?
A monetary historian. How about that?
Oh, okay, that's a good one. Yep. And I should, you know, say to our listeners, I don't think that you're particularly political. You're certainly not a liberal, you know, the way that I would describe myself. But this is something, this whole issue of H.R. 5818, the transfer of the U.S. Mint and Bureau of Engraving and Printing, this transcends any kind of partisan politics.
Absolutely. This is something liberals, conservatives, no matter which side you're on, we should all be able to agree on this.
Yeah, this is pretty mind-boggling. So let me just set this up and then let you give the details, okay. Andy Gause. It costs more to make a penny right now than a penny is worth. And because it costs more to make a penny than a penny is worth, there's a suggestion that they should because of the copper, the price of copper and all commodities have gone up, or arguably the value of the dollar has gone down. And so the federal government, you know, a law has been proposed, a bill has been proposed in the House of Representatives, H.R. 5818, known as the COIN Act, the Currency Overhaul for an Industrious Nation Act. I love these cute little titles. That says, okay, let's stop making pennies and let's require vendors to round everything to the nearest nickel. Well, that on its face seems to make sense. But buried inside this bill is something that will do something with the $2.54 billion profit. Most people don't realize the U.S. Mint operates at a profit because it makes all these commemorative coins and all kinds of stuff. They make all kinds of cool things. They actually have a $2.54 billion profit, and some friends of members of Congress would like to put that profit in their pocket rather than having it go back into the U.S. Treasury. Do I have this right so far, Andy?
Yeah, you hit it right on the head. They call that profit seniorage, and it's always existed. You know, when we had paper money, well, we have paper money. Electronic is the money of choice these days. But when our paper money, when our money was almost exclusively paper, the seniorage on paper was much greater than coins. You know, you could print a $100 bill, it cost you about 4 cents to print, and you got $99.96 worth of profit. So the very first thing that they privatized, if you will, was the paper money. And they did that in 1913, gave the
power.
That
was the Fed.
Right, gave the power to print all the paper money over to the Fed. But they left the coinage behind because it was expensive. There was not that much seniorage or not that much profit. But what happened is somewhere around 1985, we started striking those commemorative coins you were talking about, the Statue of Liberty coin, then we did the quarter
state
program.
Quarters.
Yeah, and now the dollar program. And that $2 billion profit, that was year 2000. Now the mint's turning like a $5 billion profit. And goodness, those folks that took the paper side are saying, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't have left the coin side behind. So the one thing we can all agree on, that the penny is a worthless piece of currency, that's the bill. But like you said, buried in that bill is a provision that will give the mint lock, stock, and barrel over to the Federal Reserve, so that now that $5 billion profit stream will no longer flow into the Treasury, but will flow into the Federal Reserve Board, and they can decide what would be the best way to spend it.
Right, and the Federal Reserve, of course, is owned by its member banks, who are owned by individual stockholders. So arguably, if you own stock in a bank which is a Federal Reserve bank, or a bank that is a bank in the Federal Reserve system, the dividends that you get that are only taxed a maximum of 15%, because in this country now, under the Bush administration, if you earn your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, you only pay a maximum 15% income because you're part of the investor class. That profit that used to go to help support the federal government and reduce our taxes is now going to go into the hands of investors.
Importantly, you know, when that $5 billion flowed into the Treasury, at least we got to see what Congress spends it on. And we could say, oh, look at that, it's a $10,000 hammer, or, you know, $5,000.
Right.
But now, if it flows into the Federal Reserve, they don't have to get their appropriations from Congress. They can spend that $5 billion without asking Congress and without, in effect, telling the American people. And when I audited the Fed, in my little capacity, I found a $30 million art collection. I found 47 Learjets. There are only 12 banks. They have 47 different Learjets. Every single executive has their own car and driver, subsidized dining, pistol ranges, a nice in pool. You know, the types of things that if we were bringing forward for appropriation in Congress, I think the American people would absolutely have a fit. You want to call that pork? That's more than pork.
Yeah, well, it goes beyond pork because it's not a government agency. This is a private public partnership, as it were. But it's mostly public, or mostly private rather. The Fed being owned by its member banks, and those being owned by their member banks. I remember when I was living in Vermont, Chittenden Bank was the bank that Louise and I, you know, had our checking account with, and they were doing a stock offering of their most premium stock, and they said, you know, if you buy this stock, you're buying stock indirectly in the Federal Reserve Bank, in this Federal Reserve system. You get to own a piece of the Federal Reserve.
Why, I did an article entitled, "We Are All Shareholders." So anybody who's a critic of the Fed and thinks that the Fed is not good for America shouldn't have any shares. And the way that you hold shares in the Fed is by holding their notes, Federal Reserve notes. So when you build accounts of what you call dollars, you're actually building your shares in the Federal Reserve system.
Now, that doesn't... What's the difference between having electronic dollars flying around and having paper dollars flying around from the point of view of how it affects the profitability of the Fed?
A lot cheaper to create. I mean, a paper dollar costs 4 cents. An electronic dollar is 0.00004 cents. So it represents a huge slash in the expense to make the actual paper currency.
So if we want to make it more expensive for the Fed, we should all say we want our paychecks
in
cash.
Paper. Yeah.
And buy everything in cash.
Exactly.
Then you don't get the freaking flyer miles on your credit card. You know,
well, you know, the harsh reality, when I talk about a cashless society, Tom, I feel like I'm predicting the past. But we have 95% of everything we call money is electronic in nature. Only 5% is in printed paper now.
Yeah. We're talking with Andy Goss, Andrew Goss, andygoss.com, the website, currency expert, author of The Secret World of Money. Andy, H.R. 5818, transferring the U.S. Mint and the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing over to the Fed. What do you think the odds are of the passage of this thing? And how is, you know, how is it being supported? The Democrats control Congress now. Is this being put forward largely by Democrats, largely by Republicans? Is it a totally nonpartisan thing? What's the deal here with this legislation?
It is nonpartisan. It is more of an example of, well, this is just another thing. Don't pay any attention to it. Just do it. It's only thanks to guys like you that are shining the light on this thing that suddenly the rats are scurrying. You know, they don't want to talk about it. So we can all agree on the need to eliminate the cent. But boy, this idea of giving the mint to the Federal Reserve, I'm opposed to that. In fact, I would not only keep the mint, but I would start making $5 coins and $10 coins so that we could have some of that profit that the Fed is now enjoying with the $5 bills and the $10 bills.
Who's the initial sponsor of H.R. 5818?
Well, you know, this is there are five different co-sponsors and one initial sponsor. Forgive me, his name eludes me because this is a thing that troubled me, is that it was a nobody. I mean, it's not one of the mainstream guys. It's just some representative from somewhere with five co-sponsors that, quite frankly, I've never heard of. So how this bill is going to make its way through without the support of the mainline guys, I'm not sure.
Well, it's, you know, if I was the Fed and I wanted to do something under the radar, I'd get one of the non-mainline guys to do it and make it just seem innocuous, sort of like, you know, national, pick dates in California Day or something.
Right.
Yeah. Andy Goss, you can read all about it over at andygoss.com. Andy, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Why me, George? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the plagues that you've sown? Tell me, George.
In my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
Lord help me, Jesus, we didn't vote for him, but we can't ignore him, I fear. He's using your name to advance his own game. Now we're in doo-doo way.
Now we're in doo-doo way up to here. Hey, Air Americans, head over to airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. Just go to airamerica.com and click on, you know, the link to our page. And join the blog and start blogging. Today, like day before yesterday, David Poole, our producer, is going to pick out his favorite blog entry for the day and share that with us at the end of the program today. And that person will receive a free copy of Screwed, as signed by me. The Undeclared Screw, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. My newest book. Actually, my newest book that's in print. The newest book is actually Cracking the Code, our book about the art and science of political persuasion that we wrote on the air here last year. And that will be out in a few months. And that's also available over at Amazon. You can find a link to that at tomhartman.com. Sam Brownback was aghast. Absolutely aghast. This from the Bob Geiger's blog over on the Huffington Post, and a great one, Bob. Good job. I mean, this is just great. Senator Sam Brownback was aghast. He was indignant as hell about how having a high public official involved in something like perjury and obstruction of justice can damage the very foundation on which our nation was built, and he had harsh words to show for it. This is what Sam Brownback, the Republican from Kansas, said. By his words and deeds, he chose to place himself above the law. By his words and deeds, he has undermined the rule of law in America to the great harm of this nation. The Kansas Republican said, by his own words and deeds, he has undermined the truth-finding function of the judiciary at great harm to that branch of our government. By his words and deeds, he has done great harm to the notions of honesty and integrity that form the underpinnings of this republic. And then he added, we have lost many things over the past few months. Trust in public officials, respect for the rule of law, confidence in the truth of the White House's public statements. But perhaps the most tragic loss has been the steady erosion of our societal standards. Sam Brownback, Republican, running for president right now. Speaking about Bill Clinton in February of 1999. Is he speaking out about George W. Bush? No. But let me share with you a quote from somebody who, I think was absolutely prescient. And again, on the tip of the hat to Carl Wolfson, who turned me on to this. This from George Mason. George Mason is often referred to as the father of the Bill of Rights. He wrote the Virginia Bill of Rights. The U.S. Bill of Rights, in part, was based on it. Thomas Jefferson argued for it. Mason was a close friend of Jefferson's. Mason so objected to the pardons provision of the Constitution that it was modified to say that the president can issue pardons except in cases of treason. Because, and this is George Mason's original objection to the presidential powers of the that were in the original draft of the Constitution that he helped write. 1787. One of the founders of this country, one of the founders and framers of this country, George Mason, quote, and by the way, as I read this, just consider, in my opinion, this is the real issue behind the Scooter Libby case. The real issue is not being discussed about the main, is not being discussed in the mainstream media, and frankly, is not even much being discussed in the blogosphere. This is the real issue. George Mason, 1787, quote, "The President of the United States has the unrestrained power of granting pardons for treason, which may be sometimes exercised to screen from punishment those whom he had secretly instigated to commit the crime, and thereby prevent a discovery of his, the President's, own guilt." Bears repeating, George Mason, father of the Bill of Rights, 1787. "The President of the United States has the unrestrained power of granting pardons for treason, which may be sometimes exercised to screen from punishment those whom he had secretly instigated to commit the crime and thereby prevent a discovery of his own guilt." I find it very, very curious that in the first week of February of this year, Dick Cheney went on Wolf Blitzer's show and said, I can't talk about the Scooter Libby trial because I'm going to be subpoenaed to testify. Scooter Libby's lawyers had subpoenaed Karl Rove. They were talking about subpoenaing Dick Cheney. They subpoenaed David Addington. They brought into evidence a memo in which Dick Cheney said, this president has asked this guy to do this. In other words, pointing that basically the defense that Scooter Libby, the aggressive defense in the first week of February that Scooter Libby was putting forward, first week of February this year, was that he was merely a small cog in a large machine that was being run by George Bush and Dick Cheney to out a CIA agent for revenge. And then all of a sudden on February 14th, Scooter Libby decided to roll over. He's not going to present a defense. He's not going to call any witnesses. He's not going to subpoena Dick Cheney. He's not going to subpoena George W. Bush. He's not going to subpoena Karl Rove. He's smiling a lot, and he knows he's going to be convicted now. Why? 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Country. In fact, it's happening. It is happening. Was it a coincidence or a conspiracy? Ambassador Joe Wilson, now let's just consider this. Ambassador Joe Wilson writes a New York Times op-ed piece suggesting that George W. Bush knowingly lied to the American people in a constitutionally required duty of his office. And there are very few, by the way. The Constitution specifies very few things that the president must do. He must swear an oath to protect the Constitution. He must uphold the law, because the executive branch is where the police powers are, the FBI and whatnot. He must uphold the law. And he must annually report to Congress on the state of the nation. And he is the commander-in-chief of the military. I mean, that's it. Those are the job responsibilities assigned to the president in the Constitution. So his constitutionally required duty to give the State of the Union speech contained a knowing lie. Ambassador Joe Wilson writes a New York Times op-ed article pointing this out. And his wife is punished by having her career and her life's work destroyed, along with the destruction of a major CIA undercover asset in the front company of Brewster Jennings. Coincidence or conspiracy? Well, that's part of what U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald was charged with discovering. In the process, Fitzgerald found that somebody was repeatedly trying to, quote, throw sand in the umpire's eyes, end quote, obstructing Fitzgerald's investigation into the now identified conspiracy. to destroy a CIA asset as a form of political payback. That person obstructing the investigation into the conspiracy, Fitzgerald discovered, worked at the right hands of both President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney, and was named Irving Lewis Libby, also known as Scooter Libby. Coincidence or conspiracy? In January 26th of 2007, last week of January of this year, Michael Isikoff for Newsweek reports that Libby is going to undertake an aggressive defense. White House anxiety is mounting. This from Newsweek. White House anxiety is mounting over the prospect that top officials, including Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove and Counselor Dan Bartlett, may be forced to provide potentially awkward testimony in the perjury and obstruction trial of Lewis Scooter Libby. Both Rove and Bartlett have already received trial subpoenas. Cheney is expected to provide the most critical testimony to back up Wells' assertion, Wells being Scooter Libby's defense attorney. One of the lawyers close to the case said the vice president personally penned an October 2003 note in which he wrote, "No one not going to protect one staffer and sacrifice the other." Libby's lawyer, Ted Wells, in his opening statement to the jury says, and I quote, "Mr. Libby, you will learn, went to the vice president of the United States and met with the vice president in private. Mr. Libby said to the vice president, I think the White House is trying to set me up. People in the White House want me to be a scapegoat." So then they get David Addington on the stand, Cheney's number two guy now, and have him go through this memo that Cheney wrote in which he says, "I'm not going to protect one staffer and sacrifice the guy this president asked to stick his head in the meat grinder because of the incompetence of others." In other words, the conspiracy goes all the way to the White House, all the way to the president. The press is freaking out. It looks like the president and vice president are involved in a criminal conspiracy to commit what the senior Bush called the worst kind of treason. And then 2 weeks later, the bomb drops. All of a sudden, second week of February 2007, Scooter Libby decides to lie down and let the steamroller of the criminal justice system roll all over him. He's not going to ask Rove to testify. He's not going to ask Cheney to testify. He's not going to call any other witnesses from within the White House. His lawyer isn't going to bring up the Cheney memo again. He's not even going to take the stand in his own defense. February 13, 2007. Reuters. U.S. President, Vice President Dick Cheney will not testify as expected in a former top aides perjury trial that has exposed White House efforts to counter Iraq war critics, the aides lawyers said on Tuesday. Defendant Lewis Scooter Libby, Cheney's former chief of staff, likewise will not take the witness stand, his lawyers said as they abruptly prepared to wrap up their case on Wednesday. All of a sudden, Libby decides he's not going to defend himself, guaranteeing that he's going to be convicted. He's walking around with a great big smile on his face, and friends of his like Fred Thompson are raising $5 million for him. So, coincidence or conspiracy? I'm suggesting that another crime was committed. There was the first crime of Bush and Cheney outing a CIA officer. Well, actually, there was the first crime of them lying to us, of Bush lying to us in the State of the Union Address, knowingly lying to us to get us into a war. There was the second crime of them trying to destroy Joe Wilson and his wife and also put the fear of God into anybody in the CIA who might try to tell the truth about the lies that Bush was telling. So that was the second crime, and it was a cover-up of the first crime, but it was also treasonous. And now here I am submitting to you is the third crime, and that is that somebody from the office of the president or the vice president or both went to Scooter Libby, probably in the first or second week of February of this year, and said, "Stop your defense. Stop defending yourself in court. Don't worry. Stop your defense. You will be convicted. We will set aside any jail time. And when Bush leaves office in January of 2009, he will pardon you on the way out. You won't even have a conviction on your record. If you fill out a job application and it says, have you ever been arrested or convicted, you won't even have to say yes. You can say no. Because a pardon is absolute." And so Libby decided to roll over. His friends are raising money for him. He's become a star with the right wing. And this, in my opinion, is the third impeachable offense. the third felony committed by Bush and Cheney. When you look back at the Watergate proceedings, Richard Nixon tried to stop judicial inquiries into his own crimes, and Congress investigated, and by the way, the press investigated as well, and discovered that Nixon was part of a criminal conspiracy based in the White House. This from the oath of from the Articles of Impeachment. Richard Nixon, using the powers of his high office, engaged personally and through his close subordinates and aides in a course of conduct plan designed to delay, impede, and obstruct the investigation. He made false or misleading statements to lawfully authorized investigative officers and employees of the United States, withholding relevant and material evidence or information from lawfully authorized investigative officers, approving, condoning, acquiescing, and counseling witnesses with respect to the giving of false or misleading statements to lawfully authorized investigative officers, interfering or endeavoring to interfere with the conduct of investigations, and making or causing to be made false or misleading public statements for the purpose of deceiving the people of the United States. And finally, and this is the kicker, this is from the Articles of Impeachment of Richard Nixon, endeavoring to cause prospective defendants and individuals duly tried and convicted to expect favored treatment and consideration in return for their silence or false testimony, or rewarding individuals for their silence or false testimony. That's what Richard Nixon was impeached for. And I believe this week, that's what we saw George W. Bush do. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. I quite agree with you in terms of the crimes that have been committed. But I think there's a problem. I checked the Constitution, and my version says that pardons can be granted for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment.
Right.
I don't think Mason's change got in completely.
You're right.
So
actually, you're right, yes.
Right. So here's the problem.
Did I say earlier, except in cases of treason? I misspoke. Except in cases of impeachment. You're absolutely correct, yes.
Okay, well, now what happens is, what I'm afraid of, because they're as smart as we are, your screener will cut me off if I tell you what I really think, but...
Because it has obscenities in it? Is that what you...
let's put it this way.
Follow the law here, too.
Yeah, let's put it this way. What's going to happen is going to be a bunch of Nixon pardons.
Yeah.
Bush is going to pardon everybody that worked for him. Bush resigns on the last day. Cheney becomes president. Cheney pardons Bush. Check and mate.
That's interesting. So you think that Bush will actually resign an hour before his term of office would end?
Well, actually,
563 days from now instead of 564 days from now, for example.
Right. Bush has, I would say that's...
See, I don't think he'll do that. I think he's got enough hubris and enough concern about how he's going to be treated with history that unless we force him to resign, and this is where, the press and Congress need to be doing their job now investigating this thing. And by the way, John Conyers has announced that he is going to investigate this. God bless him. Congress doing a serious investigation of this and asking the question, was Scooter Libby's sentence commuted because of a deal that was cut back in January or February? And I think that they need to bring Bush and Cheney and Addington and Rove and any of the other high officials in the White House who might have been involved in this process onto this, before Congress and have them testify under oath, because we're talking about a criminal investigation here. And the Supreme Court has ruled in U.S. versus Nixon, ruled unanimously, 9-0, that in a criminal investigation, there is no presidential privilege. There is no executive privilege. There is no possibility of the president or his, people within his branch of government refusing to testify. Can't do it if it involves a crime. And this is a series of crimes. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
9.5 minutes before the hour on the day after the 4th of July. Tom Hartman here with you live. And maybe a good time for a what a friend we have in W alert.
A friend we have in W. Upright, strong, and resolute.
Oh, he sure is.
God wished him to be our leader.
So the court just had to follow
suit.
The court
could not but follow suit.
So anyhow, a new Financial Times poll, the Wall Street Journal of the United Kingdom, finds that 32% of respondents in five European countries, when asked which country represents the greatest threat to global security, and were given a choice between Russia, North Korea, Iraq, Iran, China, other, or the U.S. The majority of them said the U.S. 32% of respondents in five European countries said the U.S. is the biggest threat to world security. Fewer than 20% voted for China, about 15%, 18% for Iran, about 11% for Iraq, about 8% for North Korea, about 6% for Russia. Yeah, just stay at home and pray, indeed. So that seems like maybe that's what we have to do. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jesse in San Diego, California. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hey, Tom, man. The Democrats just got a gift thrown in their lap. Under the Constitution, Article 3, they've got enough evidence from the trial to start a treason trial within Congress.
The Scooter Libby trial?
Yes. And the only people, according to the Constitution, that can pass out any sentences for treason is Congress.
Yeah, and Article 3, where that's the judicial branch. Do you know the reference on that?
I'll have to look because I was looking at it before I went to work, but I think it's 3-3 or something. But you know, they got a good treason case going because the war had already started when the stuff came out.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, here we are. Article 3, Section 3. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses or in the confession in open court. The Congress shall have the power to declare the punishment of treason, but no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except during the life of the person attained.
This is a gift to them.
Huh.
I mean, this bypasses impeachment. This is a slam dunk.
Yeah, that's interesting. Jesse, thanks for pointing that out. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Fascinating. Sharon in Oakland, California, listening on The Quake. Hey, Sharon.
Hi, good day. I have a message for Hillary and Nancy. I'm from Baltimore, like Nancy, I now live in California. It's a great place to live. And there's just some time where you just have to suck it up and do what's right. They impeached Bill for BS, and in my opinion, I'm a hardworking American. I don't mind helping people. I don't mind paying taxes. And I think anything that Congress does now is just throwing sand around in the sandbox. Rome is burning. The emperor has no clothes. Anything they do from now on is just nothing. Unless they pay attention to the fact that the President of the United States needs to be impeached. Everything else they do is just nothing. They may as well be napping.
If there is any evidence whatsoever, and of course there needs to be an investigation to determine whether or not there's any evidence, but if there is any evidence whatsoever, Sharon, and you're so right on this, that this commutation is a quid pro quo. That this commutation is part of a deal that was struck between the White House and Scooter Libby. You take the fall, and we'll take care of you. And you'll recall Bush famously saying he wants to know who did the leak and so that he can take care of them. Well, he has. That we'll take care of you. That's a crime. And it certainly is an impeachable crime. I mean, that's the type of crime that George Mason was writing about in 1787. David in Bainbridge Island, Washington, listening on KPTK, Talk 1090. Hey, David.
Good Good morning. I wanted to relate to you something about the Mike Malloy was talking about George Bush's indifference to death and suffering. And we all know that when he was a boy, his sister died, and the parents went on a golfing vacation the next day. On ABC's Today Show with Ann Sawyer, she was quoted as saying, "Why should we hear about body bags and death and how many, what day is going to happen and how many, it, this or that? What do you suppose? Or I mean, it's not relevant. So why should I waste my beautiful mind on something?"
Yeah, this was Barbara Bush, George's mother,
this
saying
is Barbara
that,
Bush,
know,
this
yeah.
is George's
mother. Yeah, now see,
mother.
Your point is that the Bushes are indifferent to human suffering. Bush, you know, gleefully executed, you know, several hundred people in Texas, but all of a sudden he's compassionate. I don't think all of a sudden he's compassionate. I think all of a sudden he's worried that he himself could be facing impeachment or possibly even jail time. And that's what he's trying to cover up, David, and that's what Congress needs to be investigating. Barbara in Hayward, California. Hey, Barbara.
Hi. I am so happy to get on. I am so frustrated. In fact, I think I'll run for president, the other woman. I haven't taken any corporate money. Anyway.
There you go. Real quickly, Barbara. Real quickly. We just have a few seconds.
I got a letter from Pete Stark. And he thanked me for contacting him, and he believes that they should be impeached.
So Congressman Pete Stark sent you a letter saying yes for impeachment. That's great. Barbara, thanks for the tip. 57 minutes past the hour. Michael Moore's movie, A Critique, next.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. The new Michael Moore movie, Sicko, has become something of a national phenomenon. Louise and I went to see it last Friday night here in Portland, the first night that it opened. And afterwards, we were standing outside the theater. I mean, you know, outside the door to the theater, waiting for one of our kids to get back from the restroom. And there was probably 40 people just standing around talking. I mean, you know, an ad hoc discussion group happened. I mean, it was really quite extraordinary. Here's another report. There's a link to it over at thinkprogress.org. This is a woman who went to see Sicko, Michael Moore's movie, at a mall in Dallas. And she says, when the credits rolled, the audience filed out and into the bathrooms. At the urinals, my redneck friend couldn't stop talking about the film, and I kept listening. He struck up a conversation with a random black man in his 40s standing next to him, and soon everyone was peeing and talking about just how screwed up everything is. I kept my distance as we all finished and exited at the same time. Outside the restroom door, the theater was in chaos. The entire Sicko audience had somehow formed an impromptu town hall meeting in front of the ladies' room. I've never seen anything like it. This is Texas, damn it, not France or some liberal college campus. But here these people were, complete strangers from every walk of life, talking excitedly about the movie. It was as if they simply couldn't go home without doing something drastic about what they'd just seen. My redneck compadre and his new friend found their wives at the center of the group, while I lingered in the background waiting for my spouse to emerge. The talk gradually centered around a core of 10 or 12 strangers in a cluster, while the rest of us stood around them listening intently to the thing that seemed to be happening out of nowhere. The black gentleman engaged my redneck from the restroom, shouting for everyone's attention. The conversation stopped instantly as all eyes in this group of 30 or 4 people were now on him. He said, "If we just see this and do nothing about it, then what's the point? Something has to change." There was silence. Then the redneck's wife started calling for email addresses. Suddenly, everyone was scribbling down everyone else's email, promising to get together and do something, although no one seemed to know quite what. I'm telling you, this movie is a social phenomenon. And because of that, the healthcare industry and their conservative apologists and, you know, people who think that for-profit healthcare that is designed to make a profit rather than to make people well, is the best way to have it. We're the only industrialized country in the world that has this badly a screwed up system, a for-profit healthcare system. They're out in droves now doing, hitting the press, hitting the media, saying, "Hey, wait a minute, Michael Moore is wrong. His movie is full of lies. Don't look at that man behind the curtain." Devin Herrick, for example, is with us. He's a senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, one of the new conservative think tanks. NCPA.org is the website. And Devin, I hope I haven't too harshly characterized you. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. What's your objection to Michael Moore's movie?
Well, he took the worst anecdotes of our healthcare system, which is screwed up, by the way, and compared those to a glamorized, really fictitious version of Canada and Great Britain and France.
Well, the fact of the matter is Canada, Great Britain, and France all have lower infant mortality, longer life expectancy, and spend less on healthcare than we do, and yet they, you know, so their healthcare system works better. We have a system where you've got 43 million people uninsured, 18,000 people die every year because of a lack of insurance. CNN fact checked that; they said it's right. We spend, you know, we're spending a fortune on healthcare, and you got people like William McGuire, who is the former president of United Healthcare, the second largest health insurance company in the United States, the one that AARP is using, by the way, which is why AARP supported the Medicaid bill, who takes home a paycheck of $1.7 billion, while the leading cause of bankruptcies in the United States is people getting sick. In no other country in the industrialized world do people go bankrupt because they got sick. How can you defend the system?
Well, like I say, I'm not defending our system. I think it's badly screwed up and in dire need of reform. It's just, how do we reform? Which way do we go? Do we go to a socialized system where it's have to wait in long queues to receive treatments and you tend not to get some of the best quality medicine? Or do we move the other direction toward a free market with competitive health care providers? We don't have a free market right
well,
now.
Well, you just suggested that a socialized system would automatically result in long queues and long lines and things. And the fact of the matter is we have socialized medicine in the United States.
Well,
we already
true.
Have it. It's called the Veterans Administration. And we have single payer in the United States, and it's called Medicare. And you know, the countries around the world, England has a socialized, more or less socialized medical system. France has a single payer healthcare system. Germany has a single health payer system. I lived in Germany for a year. I used it. I've used France's healthcare system. Canada has more or less a single payer healthcare system. The people in these countries are very, very happy with their systems. The vast majority of them, in all cases, every survey ever done, indicate that they would not trade it for what we have.
Well, no, they would never trade it for what they have. They like the idea. They just think they need more money shoved into it, preferably somebody else's money. But the point is that any time health care is free at the point of service and paid for through government funding, that they have to have queues simply because that is how you ration care in a system that uses prices.
Why?
That's called price rationing. But in their system, they have to have queues, and they have to limit access to high-tech equipment.
Now, well, you're always going to have rationing of health care. Here in the United States, we have rationing of health care based on what you can pay. In Canada, they have rationing of health care based on how sick you are. If you're really sick, you see a doctor within minutes. If you want a nose job, you may have to wait a year.
Well, every country in the world has some type of rationing where they, because obviously you could spend your entire GDP on health care, but you wouldn't have money for anything else. So
Well, I don't think that that's the case. But you know, one of the arguments that you guys seem to be putting out is that if we had absolutely free health care in the United States, and by the way, most single-payer systems are not like that. In Canada, you pay typically, a typical average median-income family pays about $140 a month for insurance, for the Canadian healthcare system. They pay into the system. In most countries, you pay a small amount into the system for that. But nonetheless, if we had absolutely free healthcare in the United States, you guys seem to be suggesting that all of a sudden people are going to start making appointments to see the doctor. I really don't like seeing the doctor.
Well,
I think I'm pretty typical.
I don't blame you. I don't like that's because the doctor's very inconvenient. But it's not as simple as seeing your doctor.
Well, they stick needles in you, and there's diseases in the office. I mean, I just, you know, what possible justification can you offer for us having a healthcare system where a guy makes a $1.7 billion paycheck and people are dumped on the streets of Los Angeles because they can't afford to pay for their hospital bill?
Well, as far as the compensation, that's a question for the shareholders.
No, it's not. It's a question for we the people. If health care is a right, if health care is part of that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and you can't have life without health care, if that's part of what the founders were talking about when they created this country, then, or if the modern interpretation of it is, then it to hell with the shareholders, that's something for us to decide, we the people.
Well, that's an important question. Is health care a right, or is it a service that people buy based on, like every other good and service in the market? It has not really been established that unlimited health care is a right, although we, by convention, tend to provide emergency care and some charity care for senior citizens and low-income individuals, which we do provide through a safety net. But as far as whether or not a middle-class individual has an absolute right to any medical services they want, I don't think that has been established, and I'm not convinced that the way to allocate resources most efficiently is by going from a third-party system to one where the government controls it all.
Why not?
Well, simply because
it seems to work in every other country in the world.
Because when the government controls health care, it becomes political. It's what we call the politics of medicine. The way you maximize votes is providing services to the many.
But that's how democracy is supposed to work. Government is us. They're supposed to do what we want.
Well,
you're saying that the majority of Americans want a single-payer national health care system, and that we shouldn't have it because the majority of lobbyists don't want it, and because the corporations think that that's the way. I mean, basically, it's either going to be William McGuire with his $1.7 billion paycheck and his lobbyists is going to decide what kind of health care you and I get, or we're going to decide through our elected representatives. I thought that was called democracy. I thought that's what we fought for 231 years ago.
Well, you say that the majority, want single-payer health care. You're correct that poll after poll going back 40 years has people stated, I'd be interested in national universal health care. But when they go to the ballot booth and to vote and they realize what they have to give up, their private health plan, they kind of back away. I mean,
There has never been a national vote on this.
But if there was... I think the voters would get it through if they really wanted it, if they're willing to give up what they currently have.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I think it's going to happen this year, frankly. But, in any case, good talking with you. Devin Herrick, single-payer health care, senior fellow with the National Center for Policy Analysis. His critique of Michael Moore's piece you can find over at ncpa.org. Devin, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
16 minutes.
Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Placidus Roy over in our chat room, which you can get to by going to airamerica.com and clicking on the Tom Hartman page. And there's a link there that says live chat, or you can go to tomhartman.com, and there's a link right up at the top that says live chat. Placidus Roy, tongue-in-cheek, of course. He says, I've got a card in my wallet. It says, I believe in the free market. In the event of an accident, please call at least 3 ambulance companies and get quotes. Take the middle one. Cheapest isn't always the best, but I don't need to overpay. By the way, the first hour of our program, we were talking about the Libby commutation. Coincidence or conspiracy? Complete with a quote from one of the founders of this nation, George Mason, that he was concerned that the Constitution gives the president the power to grant pardons for treason, which it does, including those people that he may have, quote, secretly instigated to commit the crime and thereby prevent a discovery of his own guilt, the president's own guilt. And the fatal flaw in the Constitution, a fatal flaw in George Mason's opinion, and I think we've found that he was right. I wrote an op-ed piece about this yesterday on July 4th. I wrote an op-ed piece about this, and Common Dreams just put it up. If you go over to commondreams.org, it's the fourth one down from the top. It's called the Libby commutation, coincidence or conspiracy. You can read it. You can post thoughts on it. Our telephone number, 1-866-303-2270. Our blog over at airamerica.com and our message board at tomhartman.com. Scott in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi. Just to preface, I actually have to start seeing patients here momentarily, but it would do justice to this conversation to actually come on and actually discuss this thing at length. But the universal health care thing will not be solved by Barack Obama, Senator Clinton, or if you want to call it President Clinton or President Obama or whatever. It will not be solved with the present situation. Now, let me expand. With patient noncompliance costing this country somewhere between $75 to $100 billion a year, go look it up. There's a white paper on the web that you can read about. It will not get solved. That is, one of the easy examples to give you is Mr. Jones, who's diabetic, insulin diabetic, and checks his blood sugars every 5 days, ends up with a BKA or below-the-knee amputation, blah, 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 whatever those kind of patients.
Right. But you're saying that's cost is $100 billion. Our total health care bill in the United States is $2 trillion. So that's either 5% or 0.5%.
But what I'm saying is...
That's not the problem.
In order
that's
to
a problem.
That much health care for that many people, if you reduce the amount of patient noncompliance, we have more than enough money in the system to get all the other people that need treatment that are doing all the things that they can for themselves, and the system would be much better off. Also, with the cost containments and rationing. The guy who mentioned about rationing is dead on. There is an amount of rationing that needs to be done.
We already have rationing. We have major rationing in the United States. The Wall Street Journal did a four-piece series on it 2 years ago. It was excellent.
Based on need. You brought up because it was based on need.
No, we have rationing based on economics, not based on need in the United States right now.
Should be rationing based on the actual procedures, not on the person's ability to pay.
Right. That's pretty much what you end up with every other country. I mean, the rationing is, I suppose, a dirty word. But, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is right now, if I want to see a specialist, I can't get an appointment for tomorrow morning. You know, at least that's been my experience.
In the present system, in order to pay the people that you have working for you, in order to pay the malpractice insurance, in order to run an office the way you have to run the office, you can't run it on Medicaid-type bills. There's no way. Offices are actually closing in some areas of the world. Like in Puerto Rico, I heard there were like numerous dental offices that closed when they mandated that everybody was free dentistry or whatever was through a Medicaid system. I heard that like 100 or 150 offices closed.
I would be very careful of I heards. You know, we've had a bunch of people on this program talk about how terrible the Canadian system is, and then all these Canadians call in and say, "Hey, wait a minute, you know, you're reciting right wing talking points."
Right.
But Scott, the bottom line is we need to reform the system. Your point is well taken, and I thank you for making it. We need to reform the system, and I would encourage people to go see Sicko, and afterwards to stand outside the theater with a clipboard and you know, either pass out information or collect people's email addresses and create little meetup groups. Maybe Meetup could do this. Maybe something could be done through Michael Moore's website. I mean, we could have easily, if I had simply said something outside the theater when we went to see it here in Portland last Friday, there's no doubt in my mind I could have gotten 100 people to sign something, a petition that says we want national health care to give to our local elected officials, to give to our senators and our members of Congress. Really simple. You can put it together yourself and just, you know, stand at the theater. Create a discussion group. Say, hey, you guys want to get together next Thursday over at the pub down the street or whatever, and let's talk about this. Or let's create an email discussion group. Or let's all meet over at Tom Hartman's discussion area over at TomHartman.com or whatever. I mean, you know, it doesn't need to be mine. And let's talk about what can be done in the United States. 1948 was when Harry Truman first introduced single-payer national health care to the United States. It was the Republicans in Congress who blocked that legislation. They've been blocking it ever since because the Republican Party is a criminal enterprise and a wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America. And frankly, of the global corporations around the planet. And it's time for we the people to stand up and say, we're going to stop them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I am a puzzle, you're the missing piece. Hang on a minute, just
34 minutes past the hour. Last year, about 1.5 million families in America filed for bankruptcy. That's, you know, 2 or 3 million Americans were directly affected by this. 1.5 million American families. And about half of them did so because they were being wiped out by medical expenses. 75.7% of them were insured at the time that they got sick. And those who were insured had average out-of-pocket costs of $11,800, and that was enough to push them over the edge. This goes beyond mind-boggling. I mean, this is incredible. I just went over to MoveOn.org to see if they had any kind of a thing that people could use to stand outside a theater or stand out, you know, after you've seen Sicko and have people sign. And there's really not something there. You can sign up for their pledge to go see Sicko. And I went over to Michael Moore's site during the break, michaelmoore.com. And, you know, was hoping to find a petition there. I didn't see anything there either. Somebody needs to put together, and hopefully, you know, somebody from one of those two organizations, michaelmoore.com or moveon.org, is listening, or some other group, put together just a generic petition that any citizen anywhere in the United States can print out, print a couple of copies of, and when you go to the movie, stand outside with a clipboard and say, would you sign this petition? And what it says is, dear elected representative, we want national health care, and we want it now. Health care should be a right, not a privilege. And then you sign, and I vote, and I will vote on this issue, among others. And then you put your name and address, and you know, basically, here I am, I'm a registered voter. And then deliver those petitions, make copies of them, and deliver copies of them to each one of the elected officials representing that area, which would include the two state senators from that state, in the case of Portland, for example, there are four members of Congress whose congressional districts are within the voice, are within the reach of this particular radio station in Portland that where I'm sitting in. And that's the case in most metro centers. There's several members of Congress that represent the L.A. area or the San Francisco Bay Area or whatever. And so, you know, deliver a copy to every one of them. And also don't forget your state senators and your state representatives or your state assemblymen. Send copies to them. Send a copy to your mayor. I mean, you know, send a copy to all of the elected officials who are supposed to be representing us. Let's get this parade going. Let's get this thing on board. Liz in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment on the national health care issue. I just returned home from living in Germany for 15 years, where they offer health care for everyone. And it works like this, and very efficiently, I might add. A person pays into it on a sliding scale according to their income level, and those who fall below a certain income level receive it free. Now, there are no co-pays, no cost in prescription costs, no waits in an emergency room or to see a doctor. And I had both my children there in Germany, and the minimum hospital stay for a woman is 7 days. And we're not talking about a third world country here. And I don't understand why in supposedly the richest country in the world we don't offer this for our people. And I think Americans aren't outraged enough because they don't know any better.
Yeah, well, you're right. Number one, most Americans don't realize that, just like they don't realize that in Germany and France you can go to college for free,
yes,
they don't realize that you get health care for free.
Yes.
And it's not for free. Everybody's paying for it, but everybody's willing to pay for it. I think everybody in the United States would be willing to pay for it, or the vast majority of us. And the reason that they don't realize that is because if you go to theyrule.net and you look at the boards of directors of the biggest health care companies and the biggest media companies in the United States, you find in many cases the same people on the same boards of directors. There is this interlocking cabal of for-profit corporations, many of them not even American corporations, many of them transnational and global corporations, mm-hmm, that are conspiring basically to rip us off. This is the reason Americans don't know about this is because we spend $2 trillion a year on health care. That's a mind-boggling amount of money. And if between 10% and 30% of that's being skimmed off the top as profit, that means that it's not just Bill McGuire with his $1.7 billion compensation package. There's a whole ton of people who are making piles of money. I mean, very substantial amounts of money, millions of dollars, and they can buy a lot of lobbyists and a lot of politicians.
Well, that's exactly right. And the thing about other countries is their governments control the costs. They control the prescription drug. I mean, how many prescription drug companies do people think there are? There are a handful for the whole world. So people in other countries are getting the same prescription drugs at a lower cost than we are. And nobody goes without, and nobody goes bankrupt.
Well, and in fact, many of the largest prescription pharmaceutical companies, drug companies in the United States are not owned by American companies. They're German companies like Merck or Bayer, or divisions thereof, you know, and operating under a whole variety of different names. So, yeah, the whole thing is a straw man. It's all about let's keep the profits in the hands of a small number of people who have been milking us dry ever since 1948 when Harry Truman first said enough already. And really now Americans are getting enough already. Liz, thank you very much. It's great to hear from you, and I appreciate the call. Karen in Alameda, California.
Hi.
Alameda.
Yeah, okay. Hi. I have a point of information and a question. The point of information is Pete Stark, my representative, does not favor impeachment. I just called his Washington office and had it confirmed. My question is, in discussion of health care, it seems like universal health care or single payer and socialized medicine are being used synonymously. I understood that there was a difference, and I was wondering if you could explain the difference between single payer and socialized medicine.
Sure. And the examples that we have in the United States are that we have both in the United States. A socialized medicine program, which is more like what they have with the National Health Service in the United Kingdom, in England, is where the government owns the healthcare system. They own the hospitals. They hire the doctors. They write the paychecks for the doctors and nurses. The administrators are all employees of the government. Basically, at every level, you're dealing with a government agency. The upside of that is it's a government agency, so it's responsive. If people don't like it, they yell at their elected officials. Their elected officials do something about it. The downside of that is that it's a government bureaucracy. The version of that that we, and some people think that any kind of bureaucracy, whether it's government or corporate, is not all that great a thing. The example that we have of that in the United States is the Veterans Administration. The Veterans Administration is socialized medicine. And so is the medical system within the Pentagon. Healthcare services for members of our armed services is 100% socialized. That's socialized medicine because the doctors are actually members of the military. They work for the government. A single payer system is like what they have in France or in Germany or in Canada, where the government does not own the hospitals. The government does not hire the doctors. The government does not, participate in the trade of the pharmaceutical companies. The government simply plays the role of an insurance company, and they write the checks to pay for things. And the difference between having the government as your insurance company, and the example that we have in the United States is Medicare.
Medicare
is a single-payer healthcare system. And the difference is that Medicare operates on a cost of administration of the naked cost of administration, the actual dollars, is 1%. When you figure in the cost of the government buildings that the people are occupying and a lot of the hidden costs, it's actually about 3%. But the cost of the employees and the paper that they move through there, it's between 1% and 3%. So let's say it's 3%. The private health insurance companies say, well, we can deliver health care at less than 3%. We can do it at 2.5% because we're efficient and we hire people at minimum wage instead of government employees at 20 bucks an hour with a pension. And they're right. The problem is that they also have to pay their CEOs hundreds of millions of dollars a year. They have the corporate jets with the gold-plated faucets in the bathroom. They've got the fancy corporate headquarters. They've got multi-million-dollar advertising budgets. They've got salespeople out there. They've got to pay dividends to their shareholders. And if they're not paying at least a rate of inflation, 3, 4, 5% dividend, they're in big trouble. So they've got to pay dividends to their shareholders. They've got to generate profits. All of these things get added in there. And so when all is said and done, while Medicare can provide health care as a single payer system in the United States for 3%, health insurance companies in the United States do it for about 30% skimmed off the top. So out of every $100 for health care that goes through a health insurance company, only $70 ends up paying for health care, whereas every $100 that goes through Medicare, $97 goes to pay for health care. And that's how it is in every other industrialized country in the world, and it works quite well. So did I answer your question?
You did. I just hope everyone realizes the difference now between socializing and single payer. which I prefer a single payer.
Yeah, I would too. Thank you very much, Karen. And in fact, Dennis Kucinich is the only guy out there who's saying, let's just go to a single payer system right now. And the closest, the other fellow who's fairly close to that is John Edwards, who's saying, let's let anybody in America buy into Medicare at that actual, 3% cost, at that low cost, and let the health insurance companies compete with them. They will eventually go out of business. That's what's going to happen. And then, you've got an evolutionary process, plus you don't have the political problem of saying, oh, we're going to put out of business an entire industry that has tens of thousands of employees tomorrow. Instead, we'll just put it out of business slowly. So I think the John Edwards system is frankly more practical. So far, Barack Obama's system is a hodgepodge. It keeps intact all the for-profit companies, as does Hillary Clinton's. I'm frankly not impressed with either one of them, but anything is better than what we've got. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
They say that Richard Corey owns one half of this whole town, with political connections to spread his wealth around. Born into society, a banker's only child, he had everything a man could want, power, grace, and style. But I work in his factory.
9.5 minutes before the hour. By the way, sickocure.org, a website for action on the bill that Dennis Kucinich has sponsored, House Resolution 676 for a national health care system, a single-payer national health care system. And they do have a page of materials that you can print out, arguments for national health care, single-payer health care, things like that. I still have not yet found any place where there's a petition that you could go to the Sicko movie with and pass out. And I think there should be. I think it'd be a great idea. Ellen Radner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
I'm going to go see Sicko in just a few hours.
It is incredible. I was talking earlier about how when Louise and I went to see it on Friday, afterwards, we were just standing outside the theater waiting for one of our kids who had gone with us to get back from the bathroom. And people were forming discussion groups. And there's this piece on, I think there's a link to it off Think Progress, about how this guy's writing about how he was in Dallas and went to just a suburban mall, and afterwards people are standing around outside the theater and somebody says, let's get a petition together, and they're starting to take down people's names and email addresses. They don't know what they're going to do, but they're going to get together and do something. And it's an amazing movie.
Well, I'm excited.
You'll love it.
Couple things. One, Tony Snow this morning was in rare form, but he's had many years trained as a conservative talk show host. He said, I don't know what Arkansasian is for chutzpah, but this is a gigantic case of it, referring to the Clintons going after President Bush for the commutation of sentence. And then he said, why doesn't Representative Conyers, Chairman Conyers' committee, look at January 20th, 2001, where they issued 140 pardons. Now, of course, one of the, and he talked about one of the people that helped get the Rich pardon was none other than Scooter Libby.
Yeah, he was the lawyer, wasn't he, involved
exactly
in that case?
He was the Rich's attorney.
Yeah. Which is kind of ironic, but what I see happening here, and I think that all this Clinton stuff is really a red herring, because Clinton didn't commit treason. And outing a CIA officer, particularly during a quote, time of war, end quote, particularly a CIA officer working on weapons of mass destruction and bringing down an entire CIA operation, in my opinion, qualifies as treason.
Well,
George,
as you know, I've said on this show before that I just think Scooter Libby, the whole issue, is a non-issue. I truly believe that, and you like my analysis some of the time, that the White House is happy as a clam to have this Scooter Libby controversy out there, because it will take the heat away from the papers, and they're not disclosing them and what's in them.
Well, this is my point. First of all, you have Joe Wilson exposing the fact that Bush lied in his only constitutionally mandated requirement, to give a State of the Union speech. He lied. And then Wilson is destroyed. His wife is destroyed. That's a crime. And then you've got Scooter Libby throwing sand in the umpire's eyes, trying to cover up an investigation into that crime. And he was successful. Fitzgerald to this day says he has been unable to successfully determine what role Dick Cheney and George Bush played in this because of Scooter Libby, because Scooter Libby to this day refuses to testify. And so, which causes me to think that a third crime was committed, and that was that a deal was cut. I mean, you'll remember the second week of February, the first week of February of this year, Libby was mounting a defense in which he was subpoenaing Cheney, Rove, all these guys, you know, were going to have to testify.
Yeah,
and then
not...
all of a sudden, in one day, he stops his defense and says he's not even going to take the stand in his own defense. At that point, he's decided he's going to roll over, he's going to lie down and roll over, and I think it's because somebody said to him, don't worry, we'll take care of you.
Well,
you
I'm
take
sure
the hit,
what was
we'll
said,
pardon
I
you.
I don't
on the...
think...
That's
in,
a crime.
The impeachable offenses, I don't think, are there. I think the impeachable offenses are going to be found in those papers dealing with the Justice Department scandal, etc. And speaking of the Justice Department scandal, Pete Domenici, who, as you know, is considered somebody that may have tried to influence the U.S. attorney in New Mexico,
right,
is now going to have a news conference sort of as we speak, actually, and is talking about his difficulties and problems with our Iraq policy.
Yeah, it's he's following in the fine footsteps of Gordon Smith and
but also
Norm,
maybe
Norm
taking
Coleman.
Trying to take some of the heat off for what happened with the U.S. attorney scandal.
Yeah, well, again, you know, I've been saying for a long time that come 2008, you're going to see every Republican in Congress and all of the senators up for re-election running against George Bush, not, you know, with him or on him. But George Mason, the father of the Bill of Rights, wrote, the President of the United States has the unrestrained power for granting of pardons for treason, which may be sometimes exercised to screen from punishment those whom he had secretly instigated to commit the crime and thereby prevent the discovery of his own guilt. I got to tell you, Alan, I am strongly of the opinion that Bush committed treason when he lied us into a war in Iraq.
Oh,
to cover up that cover up that lie, he outed Valerie Plame and intimidated CIA officers, and to cover up the fact that he had committed a crime, a second treason crime of bringing down part of the CIA, he had Scooter Libby go out there and throw sand in the eyes of the investigation, and that's a crime. And those are three, in my opinion, three impeachable crimes. And then on top of that, he went to Libby and said, and by the way, if you'll roll over on this and be silent and be a good little mafia family a member, we'll make sure that you're taken care of. And Libby did. They've raised $5 million. Scooter's had a nice smile on his face through this whole thing. I'm looking at four major felonies, four crimes, and frankly, I have to just strongly
disagree with you. And I just don't think
Congress
is going to go with that. I think Congress is going to get people much more incensed, and the trail is going to go warmer on the Justice Department issue.
Yeah, well, I think they're both impeachable offenses, frankly. But, you know, Nixon, one of the articles of impeachment said, endeavoring to cause prospective defendants to expect favored treatment and consideration in return for their silence. That was one of the things Nixon was impeached for. And that's what just happened. So I think it's right. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen. Good talking
to you. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too. And enjoy the movie. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
The two primary themes of our show today, although we've covered a lot of territory and there's a lot of news, a lot of things going on out there, are number one was the commutation of Scooter Libby's jail sentence, the result of a deal that was cut with the Bush-Cheney White House that Scooter would not mount a defense of himself in exchange for the vice president and the people around him having to testify in open court and under oath, and Karl Rove having to testify. In other words, don't defend yourself, we'll take care of you. And if so, you know, is that going to be seriously investigated? Because that would be a major felony. That is obstruction of justice. That's the definition of obstruction of justice, number one. And number two, the incredible popularity of Michael Moore's film and health care. And speaking to that second issue, speaking to the first issue, by the way, I wrote an op-ed piece that you can find over at commondreams.org right now. You might want to check it out. Speaking to the second issue, Sarah Van Gelder is with us here. She's the executive editor of Yes Magazine, the website yesmagazine.com. A nice intuitive website there. And Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
You went to Cuba, much like Michael Moore did, and looked at their healthcare system. Do I have that right?
That's right. I was there for about 2 weeks in December this last year. No.
And, you know, Michael Moore points out in his movie, I mean, he doesn't say it, but it's on the screen, that Cuba actually, while we're 37th in the world, Cuba is 39th in the world. They don't have the world's best healthcare system. But on the other hand, Cuba is a third world, an impoverished third world country. So among impoverished third world countries, they have one of the best healthcare systems in the world, at least according to the United Nations ranking. What did you see when you were there?
Well, what I saw was doctors in basically every neighborhood in Cuba. I saw a sense among ordinary people that if they were sick, they could go see a doctor, that wasn't going to be a problem. There wasn't a question of, oh, my gosh, is my insurance going to cover this or that? It was a question of, you know, what do I need, and, you know, what resources does this impoverished country have to bring to solving my problem? Cuba especially puts a lot of emphasis on prevention. So when there's a problem coming up, it's often the kind of thing that a lot of people are experiencing. In a lot of third world countries, it might be dengue fever, it might be tuberculosis, it might be parasites, and Cuba has long ago taken on a preventative approach to those, so that unlike a lot of other poor countries, people in Cuba do not die of those kinds of ailments, and most of them are quite healthy. And they live to be as old as we do in the United States, and their infant mortality rate is actually lower.
Now, there is nobody in Cuba making billions of dollars off the healthcare system. There's nobody in Cuba making money running hospitals. There's nobody in Cuba making money becoming millionaires as a physician. How can you have a healthcare system that actually works when your doctors get the same salary as pretty much, you know, as a school teacher, when the agencies that are providing, that are making sure that payment is taken care of and that supplies are available are working for the government, and there's no profit motive?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people go into medical service because they want to do just that. They want to serve people. They want to, you know, help people get healthy. And, you know, it's interesting in this country, you hear a lot of doctors and nurses feeling burned out because they're being channeled through this assembly line that does generate a lot of profits for the folks at the top, but sort of takes the enjoyment and the sense of purpose out of the work of being a doctor. You hardly get to know your patient, much less really help them understand what their health condition is and how to be healthier. So
now I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I mean, the medical system in Cuba, they've chosen to train a great number of doctors. So they not only have enough doctors so they can have one in every neighborhood in Cuba living in the neighborhood where they can be getting to know their neighborhood and helping people solve their problems before they get to be big problems. But they have so many doctors, they've also been able to export them now to 69 different countries around the world.
And thus Cuba, a backward third world impoverished nation, has a longer lifespan and a lower infant mortality rate than the United States?
The lifespan is just about the same. The infant mortality rate is lower, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And they're not limiting. Now, here in the United States, the American Medical Association limits the number of doctors who can graduate from medical school every year. And if you want to go to medical school, be prepared to borrow $100,000 to $150,000. They do that quite differently in Cuba.
That's right. Medical school is free, and not only is it free for Cubans who pass the necessary exams, but they're also providing free medical educations to students from, I believe it's 28 other countries, including the United States.
There are U.S. citizens who are in Cuba going to medical school?
That's right. There's about 90 students now. What happened is some members of the Congressional Black Caucus were traveling around the world, and they kept running across Cuban doctors or Cuban-trained doctors in some of the poorest communities, and they said, okay, what's the story here? How is this happening? Mm-hmm. Went to Cuba, had a conversation with Fidel Castro, and the long and short of it is that he said, you know, I'll train young Americans also if they'll promise to go back, the same deal as the other medical students, if they'll promise to go back and serve the impoverished communities within the United States. And on that basis, there's now 90 students studying in Cuba from the United States.
When did this start?
Let's see. The first, there is just one student who's graduated so far.
Uh-huh.
So it was just a few years ago.
And has that student been able to pass the U.S. boards and get U.S. board certified and practice in the United States?
Yes, I believe he has. And the process is very similar to other students who study abroad, get their medical degrees abroad. There are exams they have to take when they get back. But
sure, the infamous school in Grenada that Ronald Reagan had to rescue.
That's right.
Yeah. Interesting. Sarah Vandegelder, the executive editor of Yes Magazine, yesmagazine.com. Any final notes that you'd want us to know about the Cuban system and lessons we might learn for ours?
Well, I think the main thing is that the universal health care is possible. I mean, the fact that everyone in Cuba is absolutely clear that they can have access to medical care, that it's not doesn't have to be out of sight. It doesn't have to. We're spending $6,000 a year per person in the United States, and yet we're so poorly covered, and in Cuba they're spending a few hundred. Now, we probably can't get down to just a few hundred because of a number of structural reasons, but we can certainly provide medical care to every single human being who lives in the United States, and, you know, they're showing us one route to doing it.
Right. And you can find the article that Sarah wrote about this over at yesmagazine.org. There's an entire article about this. Sarah, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. It's fascinating, you know, what you've done, what you've been doing, and I salute you for it. And Yes Magazine is a great publication. A lot of, you know, fine information there. An amazing collection of things going on around the world right now. In particular, here in the United States, and it's, apropos of this, sicko playing in Texas and people showing up and saying, hey, let's get together and do something. The entire sicko audience had somehow formed an impromptu town hall meeting in front of the ladies' room. I've never seen anything like it, writes a correspondent. You can see the article over at thinkprogress.org. In fact, we're going to have the editor of Think Progress blog with us here in a few minutes. Al Gore on the Today Show. See, this is amazing, because Al Gore is, I think, probably the first high-profile media figure to have actually said what I wrote about this morning on commondreams.org. This morning, this from the Think Progress blog, this morning on NBC's Today Show, Vice President Al Gore called last week's commutation of Scooter Libby's prison sentence, quote, very disappointing. Well, that's a bit of an understatement. And improper, specifically highlighting the fact that Libby, quote, had knowledge that could incriminate his bosses in the White House, which included the vice president and the president. And, you know, that's the point that I've been making, is that what we're looking at here is a cover-up. We're looking at a major cover-up. And it's a cover-up of the type that George Mason was concerned about, that the president could pardon in order to avoid prosecution of crimes committed by the president, Al Gore, on the Today Show.
The fact that the president commuted his sentence. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I thought it was very disappointing.
Because?
Well, I thought it was improper. He's charged with having knowledge that could incriminate his bosses in the White House, which included the vice president and the president. I thought it was very disappointing.
And how is it different than when President Clinton pardoned in some controversial cases?
Well, it's different because in this case, the person involved is charged with activities that involve knowledge of what his superiors in the White House did.
In other words, Bush and Cheney, Bush is commuting the sentence of a guy who could incriminate Bush. And that, you know, that did not happen at any time, under any circumstances, with Bill Clinton or any other president in the past, other than Richard Nixon, who got impeached for it. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program on Air America. Hey, by the way, head over to the airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page and join in our blog. David will be picking his favorite blog entry for the day, and he'll be sending that person a copy, an autographed copy, of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So what are the stories that are flying under the radar? We've been talking about the stuff that's right on the surface, and boy, is it on the surface. The President of the United States pardoning the guy who might be able to have the President of the United States put in jail or impeached. I mean, this is a little different than pardoning a campaign donor, for example. That's fairly obvious stuff. Sicko doing really well, the American healthcare system not. And, you know, the obvious, the war in Iraq and all these other things are ongoing. Christy Harvey's with us right now. She's the Director of Strategic Communications for the Center for American Progress. Also creates the daily news prep site, MikeCheckRadio.org over there. The main website, AmericanProgress.org. Christy Harvey, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good, good. And by the way, I keep saying pardoning, I mean commuting. Thank you, Louise, for that. Christy, what I wanted to talk with you about, you're you know, in the epicenter of the news explosion that's happening in Washington, D.C., and there's a lot of stuff that goes unreported, that's sliding under the radar. It's under the radar of the mainstream media. Some of it's even under the radar of the blogosphere, as it were, of those of us who consider ourselves, a little ahead of the mainstream media. And so I wanted to check in with you and get your take on what you think are the major stories that are really going unreported, but we should be attending to.
Well, thank goodness, because I've decided not to talk Libby anymore for exactly 1 week. I got a stomach ache, and I couldn't figure out why my stomach hurt so much, and it was because I'd gotten myself so worked up this week, so I'm taking a break. But
yeah, well,
there's other things. There's other things, obviously, out there to make my stomach hurt. Did you see the story today that's breaking about what's going on with the U.S. Embassy in Iraq?
You mean the absolute mess that the contractors are making of it?
A huge mess, beyond mess. There, of course, we're building this $592 million embassy over there. Huge, biggest embassy in the entire world. And the contractors finished part one, the $22 million guard structure, the guard base. And so the guards went to move in, and all of the wires melted in the kitchen, just melted down. It turned out that the contractors had used shoddy wiring instead of 10-millimeter wires. They used six. Then they tried to go to sleep, and all of the sleeping facilities were filled with formaldehyde fumes. Then they realized that all of the fuels from the 10 different generators around the embassy had leaked all of their fuel into the soil. And what had happened there was the contractors patched up these generators and their fuel tanks with something called Teflon tape, which is fabulous for water heaters. But if it touches diesel fuel like these had, it melts.
Oh, my.
So my favorite line, and by favorite I meant the one that made me scream this morning, was they asked the State Department. So the diplomats over in Iraq sent this memo to the State Department and said, "What the heck is going on over here?" And the State Department, first of all, was mad that they pointed it out publicly and didn't do it, you know, behind closed doors where the Washington Post wouldn't hear. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, an officer at the State Department had signed off on this project, calling it, quote, one of the better built facilities in Iraq.
Which, well, you know, that's...
It's a little like being one of the smarter girls on America's Next Top Model. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's
just... the tallest midget in America kind of thing. Not to diss midgets, but who were the principal contractors on this?
The principal contractors were a group called First Kuwaiti, and that's where it gets a little weirder, because First Kuwaiti is already under investigation by the State Department, because they have this fancy little trick. They've done some other work for us over in Iraq, and they have this little trick where they bring in foreign workers, tricking them, telling them that they're going to Dubai, bringing them to Iraq to do the work, and confiscating their passports so they can't escape. So that's they're those guys.
Whoa.
And the bad part is they're the ones doing the whole rest of the embassy. So if there's already problems with the smaller guard base, you know, these are the guys who are in charge of doing the whole rest of it. So It's just, it's an ugly, ugly story. But I hear that the House is all up in arms about this and is looking to have some hearings sometime soon. So
right.
Hopefully.
Good. Let's hope so. And finally, we have about a half a minute. This week, the Department of Transportation got caught calling federal and state lawmakers.
Yeah, they're upset about California wanting to have stronger emission standards. And so the Department of Transportation, who are, you know, really tight with the car industries, started calling all of these different lawmakers in different states and saying, hey,
call the EPA
and tell them to stop.
We have federal employees lobbying state lawmakers. Isn't that against the law?
It is, as Henry Waxman called it, improper and quite possibly illegal. So, yes, Tom, it is.
Indeed. Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Christy, thanks for the insights today.
Thanks a lot.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Guys, again, we're going down the wrong road, my friends. Let's return our nation to its true destination. Let's be the good guys again.
Yeah, that's what those high school students, the honors graduates, said to George W. Bush. A petition, 50 of them, saying, you know, we'd like to be the good guys again. And Bush goes, we don't torture. No, you stop renditions. Stop Guantanamo. We'd like to be the good guys in the world. We don't torture. Yeah. Tragic. It was truly, truly tragic. Time for our best of the rest of the news segment, where we invite a couple of folks in from the blogosphere and to talk about what they're seeing, what they're hearing, the stories that they're hearing, what their sense is of how things are happening and what's going on out there in the real world. Steve Rendall is with us, or is it Rendell?
It's Rendell, Tom. It's great
Rendell,
to be back.
Thank you.
Great to be back.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah, great to have you with us again from FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org, and Faz Shakir?
That's right. Yes, sir.
Faz Shakir from the Center for American Progress, the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, which I check every single day, thinkprogress.org. And great to have both of you with us. Steve, I'd like to start with you. What stories do you see as the largest stories coming down the road right now throughout this week?
I think the lack of a health care debate following the release of Sicko, and with what part of the one-sided debate there is, basically trashing the notion that Americans are actually quite fond of the idea of having a universal health care system that would be funded by the government. In fact, a CNN poll just a couple of weeks ago showed 64% of respondents supported the idea that, quote, government should provide a national health insurance program for all Americans, even if this would require higher taxes, close quote. That fact is missing from most of the discussions, most of those pieces, Jeff Greenfield on CNN, USA Today, trashing Sicko and trashing its one of its major messages. Also,
so
of course, the Libby commutation is huge news, and several other stories as well.
Right. I should also mention Steve is a FAIR senior analyst and co-host of his national radio show Counterspin. Steve, the national media is almost without exception ignoring the fact that the vast majority of Americans want national health care. Why would the corporate media in this country do that, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, I think there's just a built-in conservatism, but there's reasons for that. There's structural reasons. The pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry are huge advertisers. In some cases, the boards of directors of giant media companies also sit on the as boards of directors on pharmaceutical or insurance companies. So I think there's some clear transparent structural reasons why they would. But it's also a fact that our corporate media is fond of maintaining a debate between the corporate-friendly center and the even more corporate-friendly right. And so, therefore, you always get these debates between people like Coulter or Lowry, these sorts of people from the National Review or Human Events, and people from the center like Joe Klein, from right. Time magazine.
So it's from the corporate middle to the right actually. That's right.
And so, for instance, you have Jeff Greenfield on CNN saying that, yeah, they have these universal health care systems elsewhere, but Americans are different. You also have Ron Brownstein in the LA Times saying pretty much the same thing, that it's the American experience is exceptional, and therefore we don't really like that stuff. But what they should be saying is, we fat, happy pundits don't like that, and the people who pay us don't like that, because the American people
do. In particular, the people who pay them, because they're buying the advertising. Faz Shakir over at the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org's blog. You're the research director for the Center for American Progress, and you serve as the editor of thinkprogress.org and the Progress Report. What are you seeing as the top stories right now?
Well, to echo what was said before, I think the Libby commutation is really a hot topic on the blogosphere. There's so many different layers to it. I think some of the ones that pop out to me are the congressional activities that are going to go on next week about this. One is John Conyers, the House Judiciary Committee chairman, is going to hold a hearing on the use and misuse of presidential pardon power and clemency power next Wednesday at noon. The other thing I would note is Representative Robert Wexler of Florida is going to introduce a censure resolution against President Bush for his use of the commutation order in the Scooter Libby case. So those will be interesting congressional moves to note. And then, of course, on Iraq, there's a lot of activity going on. Today we learned that Henry Waxman is going to be holding a hearing on the reconstruction failures at the Baghdad embassy that we learned about in the Washington Post today. And the other one thing I would note to keep going on Iraq is that Senator Domenici of New Mexico, I think, is going to become the latest conservative senator to jump off the Bush bandwagon and announce that he wants to call for a redeployment of U.S. troops.
Is he up for re-election in 2008?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Good question.
Yeah, we're seeing this obviously with Norm Coleman and Gordon Smith. As soon as they're up for re-election, so all of a sudden they're changing their tunes, which Republican senators tend to do every 4 years. The 2 years before the election cycle, they suddenly become quote moderate end quote, even though they've been consistently and historically voting as right-wing extremists. Steve Rendell, what are you seeing coming down the road? What are the stories that you're expecting that are going to be the important stories of next week and the weeks in the future?
Well, I think the Libby commutation will stay with us for a while. I mean, I think, as was stated, there are so many layers to it. There's, for one, we're media critics at FAIR, so we look at the media issue. You have people like Timothy Noah at Slate saying pretty much that Bush did the right thing. The nominally liberal Slate. Declaring that the commutation was sensible and it was right to do, basically his argument being that, everyone knows that Bill Clinton committed perjury and he got off, so let's give a free one to Scooter Libby.
Yeah, I saw this guy on TV and I'm like, what? Where did they, under what rock did they find this?
Think that Bill Clinton should have been found guilty of perjury, I don't see under law why that would have any effect on what the outcome would be. But besides, the biggest point there is that comparing Bill Clinton's comments made about his ribald sex life to a jury, to Scooter Libby's part of a campaign.
Well, and Clinton didn't pardon himself, or he didn't commute his own sentence. I mean, that's my concern, is that George Mason's prophetic comments back in 1787 that the Constitution should have a provision in it that prevents the president from pardons or commutations in the case of treason. Because if it doesn't, and it didn't, and this is why Mason ultimately refused to sign the Constitution, if it doesn't, then the president may engage in treasonous activities and then commute the sentences of people. Here's the exact quote. This is from George Mason, one of the founders.
Right.
The president of the United States has the unrestrained power of granting pardons for treason, which may be sometimes exercised to screen from punishment those whom he had secretly instigated to commit the crime and thereby prevent a discovery of his own guilt.
Right, exactly. And this might not be treason in this case, but it does appear that Scooter Libby's sort of pulled back, reined in his defense there at some point.
He shut it down. He shut it down on February 14th of this year. He shut it down. He's all of a sudden, in one day, decided, no, not going to call any witnesses. All those subpoenas, we're going to nullify them. He's not even going to take the stand in his own defense.
Yes, and that's suspicious. That bears only more journalistic investigation, but official investigation as well.
Faz Shakir over at thinkprogress.org. What do you see coming down the road over the next few weeks?
Well, on the just to pick up on that conversation, and also to clarify a point earlier, Senator Domenici is up for re-election in 2008, and that probably explains why he's jumping off the Bush bandwagon at this point on Iraq. On the discussion that was being held earlier about the commutation, it was interesting what I saw as Al Gore was on the Today Show this morning saying, clarifying the distinction between the Clinton pardon and what we're seeing now with Libby, and he said, well, it's different because in this case, the person involved is charged with activities that involve knowledge of what his superiors in the White House did, of course, echoing what was just said. So I think it's useful to continue this talking point. The other one, I think, is the distinction between the processes of an impeachment and what happened in the Libby case. In an impeachment, I think, the House had decided to vote for articles of impeachment, but then the Senate ultimately rejected them, so the process ended. But in the Libby case, the process went completely through, and we saw a jury of his peers and then a judge sentence him to prison, and then that process was cut off. And so that, and I think as you're looking at those two specific processes, one came to its fair and reasonable conclusion, the other one was completely cut off.
Yeah, and thus irrationally so. Steve Rendell over at fair.org, Faz Shakir, thinkprogress.org. Faz, thanks for that analysis. Steve, just one last question, since you guys are watching the media, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, fair.org. How do you think that there's any possibility that the media is going to pick up on this thing that Al Gore was talking about today that I wrote about over at Think Progress, or over at, excuse me, at commondreams.org, that it's possible that the commutation was to further conceal the crimes of Bush and Cheney themselves?
Well, if it was, that would seem to be obstruction of justice, and that would definitely be another count. Not that there's any shortage of cases or charges to be made for impeachment, but let me leave you with this thought, and that is that I think a lot of what's happened in the last several weeks is leading up to a campaign. I'm hearing more sort of chatter in the background to impeach Dick Cheney.
Yeah, which is, of course, the articles of impeachment that are already before the House right now. Steve Rendell of fair.org, Faz Shakir of thinkprogress.org. Gentlemen, thank you both very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. We'll be talking.
Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And not a moment too soon, without a minute to spare. You touched my heart.
Well, it's really sweet. Now we got to save the country. Welcome back. Hey, congratulations to Tara Vitale.
Roosevelt is dead.
Whoa. Wrong button. Sorry about that. Tara Vitale. That's much better to have applause than Limbaugh. Ever see a group of 8-year-olds playing soccer? They all run to where the ball is instead of staying in their position. No matter how well coached they are, that's the nature of 8-year-olds. They don't understand the nuances of the game or have the discipline to play it the way they're coached. The current media is like that. Instead of staying on the story like Woodward and Bernstein did with Watergate, they lose interest and run to the next story. There have been a whole series of scandals that have been forgotten because the media doesn't stay their position or play their position the way they should. Remember the Downing Street memos? They're supposed to be the smoking gun. Then the Plame affair heated up and the media ran there. Then it was warrantless wiretapping. Maybe the media need to go on Ritalin. Yeah, so congratulations to Terabyte. I guess it's Terabyte One, not Terabyte, or maybe it's Terabyte Tell. I can never Lowercase L's and 1's always look the same to me. We're going to be sending you a copy, an autographed copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and thanks for participating over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page in our blog. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Julie in Berkeley, California. Hey, Julie.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call, and thanks so much for being on the radio. I, too, went to the opening night of Sicko, and it was in the Bay Area, and they were leafleting the California Nurses Association and the National Nurses Organizing Committee, and they said, help us to pass these excellent bills that they have at the national and state level. They said either sign up online at www.sickocure.org. I know you've already got that. Or you can fill out this thing and send it to a physician for a national health program. But sicko.cure will get people there. In California, singlepayernow.net specifically. And I'm a social worker, and I'm inviting any listening social worker to join in this campaign.
Great. And also PNHP, Physicians for National Health Program, .org, I'm pretty sure is the website for that group. I was their keynote speaker 3 years ago.
Must have
been more like 4 or 5 years ago in San Francisco at their annual convention. Yeah. Great group of docs who are really concerned about this. Julie, thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you and great to hear that that's going on. Is it Cecily in Nashville, Tennessee?
Yes.
Cecily, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I've been so frustrated and angry about this commutation of Libby's sentence this weekend, and I was trying to figure out what to do. So our week, the 4th of July, is really kind of messing up my week. But next week, I'm starting a national call-in for impeachment. Every day next week, people need to call their representatives every single day next week and call for impeachment, call for investigations. They can even start this week, today and tomorrow, by calling their local offices, which is always really good, but trying to get some national organizations on board with this, MoveOn.org and True Majority. But if we can just get people from all 50 states calling their representatives every day next week, demanding that they do something about this administration, we may be able to get something done.
Good on you, Cecily. And the phone number for Congress is 202-225-3121, and there's a whole variety of 800 numbers out there. They change from day to day. The most recent one that I was using was 866-220-0044. But, you know, long distance is cheap these days. Typically, just calling. In fact, for a lot of folks, it's free. 202-225-3121, the telephone number for Congress. Richard in Ukiah, California. Hey, Richard.
Well, hi. I wanted to talk to you about one thing, but while I was on the phone waiting, I realized I should mention that I'm in Ukiah, California, but I'm actually just out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And if you want to give Senator Strangelove, Pete Domenici, a lot of grief, just look into the deal that he did running a highway through the Petroglyph National Park in order to get some land of his to increase in value. I'm sure that the Indians there in New Mexico would be happy to tell you about that. But what I really called about was the Sicko movie. Up here in Ukiah, we're 2 hours out of San Francisco, and the Regal Theater Company has deemed that they don't really think we're going to need to see that here. So if I want to see it, I'm going to have to drive an hour and an hour back to Santa Rosa. And since Regal Theater is real recognizable, those are the people with Fandango, I would suggest that any of your listeners, if they have the choice to pick a different theater in protest, maybe go to Century or...
Well, that's weird, because I saw it at a Regal Theater here in Portland.
Yeah, they do. They are showing it at Regal Theaters. They just won't show it out here in the boonies.
Yeah, so, well, I guess you need to be lobbying them and pointing it out, yeah. And keep at it. Get all your friends to do it. But, Richard, thank you very much, and great to hear from you, Kai. Michael and Justine Toms live out there, some great friends with a great radio program. Joe in Florida. Hey, Joe, got about a minute. What's up?
Hey, real quick, just wanted to give my 50 thumbs up for Sicko. You got to see it. Also calling from the state of Florida, I feel that the Bush crime family doesn't have the hold it had on with the other criminal, Jeb Bush, who ran the state for 8 years. I didn't vote for the current governor, but I have to say that I'm cautiously optimistic about him. He seems like an honest person, and I think that the Dems need to concentrate on Florida. I think they can win it in the next election, and I think it's about time we knock the Bushes right on their ass and take the gloves off with this upcoming week when they get back from their holiday. It's about time. We need to knock the Republicans on their asses.
It's about time is a great phrase, Joe. Thank you very much. We'll continue your calls tomorrow. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, Anything Goes Friday. Senator Bernie Sanders will be with us for our first hour, Brunch with Bernie, and then we'll be taking your calls on any topic you want throughout the rest of the day at 866-303-2270. Check out our blog at airamerica.com and tomhartman.com. That and your calls here on the Tom Hartman program. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.